continues its bombing and shelling campaign in Gaza as death toll for more than 6 months of indiscriminate attacks tops 33,600. The UK government comes under fire from human rights groups for refusing to end arms sales to Israel amid the regime's ongoing campaign of genocide in Gaza. And in Australia, authorities say several people have been killed as a man armed with a knife attacks shoppers at a busy mall in Sydney. Top story. Israeli military's unrelenting attacks on the Gaza Strip continue to claim more civilian lives. Almost 30 people were killed when a home in central Gaza city was hit, and another 20 civilians lost their lives in Israeli strikes in other areas of the coastal sliver. Israeli forces also targeted a number of journalists in the Nusayra refugee camp in central Gaza. Now, according to medical sources, one of the journalists is now in critical condition. More than 33,600 people have been killed in Gaza since Israel launched its campaign of genocide on October 7th, and thousands are still missing. A Geneva-based human rights organization has estimated over 13,000 Gazans are unaccounted for. The Euro-Mediterranean Human Rights Monitor says many of those missing are either buried under rubble or in indiscriminate mass graves. In the Gaza Strip, civil defense volunteers are trying to retrieve bodies from under rubble of bombed-out buildings following the withdrawal of Israeli forces from the city of Khan Yunis. As the regime's indiscriminate attacks continue, our correspondent Muti Abu Musaba joined us earlier from central Gaza with your details.
In the meantime, when it comes to Khan Yunis city, as you know, that the medical staff and the civil defense crews still this moment are working on extracting more dead bodies and corpses which were left behind the massive destruction inflicted by the Israeli occupation forces in that area. Over the last 24 hours, 10 Palestinian dead bodies were extracted from the rubble of those destroyed houses, particularly in Al-Amal neighborhood located in the western part of Khan Yunis city. So the current situation is still tense across all areas of Gaza Strip, basically here in the central area of Gaza Strip and Nusayrat refugee camp, where the Israeli military operation is still underway with more relentless attacks against that area. What happened in Khan Yunis is horrific because, as you know, that for roughly 4 consecutive months and the Israeli occupation forces have been attacking and were attacking that area, including the aerial, the land, and even the sea attacks from the sea. The entire residential buildings were destroyed. We are talking about entire residential squares that were wiped out of the map. 1% of the house units and the constructions and the buildings in Khan Yunis city were completely or partially destroyed, knowing that Khan Yunis was the second largest city in Gaza Strip. So now Khan Yunis was literally reduced to be the city of rubble. Wherever you turn your eyes in Khan Yunis city, you would observe and see the rubble and the mounds of debris left behind those constant and chronic attacks that were hitting that area. What happened in Khan Yunis is indescribable, unbelievable, because everything was reached by the Israeli occupation forces on the ground or by the Israeli warplanes was destroyed completely, including the infrastructure, the streets, the residential buildings, the health facilities. Everything was destroyed. Khan Yunis was completely reduced to be an unlivable place.
Palestinian resistance forces have launched fresh attacks on several Israeli cities and settlements in occupied territories. The Al-Quds Brigades, the military wing of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement, says its forces have carried out the attacks. The resistance fighters have targeted the city of Sidarat and several other settlements surrounding Gaza with multiple rockets. There's been no report yet of damage or fatalities, but the Islamic Jihad movement also said attacks are in response to Israeli regime's crimes against Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. UNICEF car comes under fire in northern Gaza earlier this week on its way to deliver aid to malnourished children. That was the latest incident of targeting aid groups by the Israeli forces in Gaza, where people are already struggling and starving due to the regime's restrictions on the entry of aid. Now let's take a listen to a UNICEF spokesperson explain how this attack unfolded.
So I was in that car that was hit. It was waiting at a holding point just south of the Wadi Gaza checkpoint, where we are often instructed to wait before being called through the checkpoint. We were waiting there as instructed, and gunfire broke out in the vicinity. It seemed to be coming from the direction of the checkpoint towards civilians, who then turned and fled from the checkpoint. Luckily, myself and my colleagues, we were all safe, but this just underscores how dangerous it is for humanitarian aid workers in Gaza at the moment, that incidents like this continue to happen when they absolutely shouldn't. See, we decided to go ahead because it was such a critical mission, with nutrition products for the children who are malnourished in the north of Gaza, among other things. Unfortunately, after deciding that we would go ahead, we were still delayed. We waited at that holding point for at least another 2 hours before deciding that the mission was no longer feasible, because we didn't have enough time, even if we were given the green light, to go up, conduct all of our activities, and then get. It's tragic to see anybody suffering from malnutrition, which is such a painful condition, let alone in a place where malnutrition was almost non-existent before October, and it's now skyrocketed in the north of Gaza because of disruptions to food production, but also because of restrictions on aid access to that area. We've really struggled to get up there with aid, and as a result, we know that children are dying of malnutrition there. At least 23 children have reportedly died at the Kamal Adwan Hospital, which is where we were trying to bring these nutrition treatments on Tuesday.
People in the occupied West Bank have held a funeral for two Palestinians killed in an Israeli raid. The two Palestinians were killed in the city of Tubas in northeast of the occupied West Bank. Mohammed Rasul Daragma was killed after occupying forces opened fire on his vehicle. Elsewhere in the central West Bank, armed Israeli settlers attacked two villages near Ramallah. One Palestinian was killed and over 20 injured. Settlers also set dozens of Palestinian cars and homes ablaze. There's been a drastic rise in number of attacks by Israeli forces and settlers against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank since the regime launched its campaign of genocide on Gaza in early October. Since then, at least 462 Palestinians have been killed in the occupied territories. Our correspondent in Ramallah joined us earlier with more details about Israeli settler attack on a village near Ramallah.
A third Palestinian has been killed by the Israelis this day, but this time Israeli settlers had killed a young Palestinian man, Jihad Afif Abu Aliya, from the village of Al Mghayr, northeast Ramallah. The Israeli settlers had raided the village of Al Mghayr, and they attacked Palestinians and their vehicles, their homes. They burnt properties, they burnt vehicles, they opened fire at the residents of Al Mghayr, killing one Palestinian and wounding 18 others. At the same time, Israeli forces stormed Al Mghayr in order, of course, to make sure that the settlers are not being attacked or hurt by the Palestinians there, and at the same time to continue attacking the Palestinians there. Why the Israeli settlers had been raiding Al Mghayr, it's not the first time. The Israeli settlers continue to storm these areas, northeast Ramallah, like Al Mghayr, Termusaya, Sinjal, and these Palestinian towns and villages are located very close to the illegal settlements that are built on the Palestinian lands. The Israeli authorities claim that a shepherd settler was still missing since the early hours of Friday, and the search is still continuing. They could not, of course, find this settler.
Now, Lebanon's resistance movement, Hezbollah, and Israeli forces once again exchanged fire along the southern Lebanese borders, things remain tense over the Israeli regime's onslaught on Gaza. Hezbollah says it's fired dozens of rockets towards occupied Palestine, as well as the occupied Golan Heights. And this after Israeli warplanes targeted several Lebanese villages and towns. Earlier, we're joined by our Beirut correspondent, Mariam Saleh, for more.
Operations from Lebanon, but we noticed that from the Israeli side, the shelling continued, and we saw an intensification today where they launched and targeted several houses in Ayta Shah, but also in the town of Taibe, which is still one of the towns that is inhabited. It has not been displaced. It has not been evacuated. It's not a bordering town. So Hezbollah basically made a stance with what we heard from the launching of the Katyusha rockets. Hezbollah has mentioned in their statement that they said tens of rockets were launched towards the barracks of Zaoura. And Zaoura is one of the main barracks where the Israelis basically launch their artillery. It's a launching site. They have many vehicles over there, artillery vehicles especially. They're usually also Merkava tanks in that barrack specifically. So basically, it's a very large military parking lot for their artillery vehicles. Hezbollah made it clear that they are ready to make that stance and to retaliate for the targeting of areas that are considered residential and civilian, although we did not see, we don't have clear casualties from the civilian population, but still in itself, when the Israelis target a civilian house and it is destroyed, then Hezbollah does retaliate in that manner. And we saw that Hezbollah also have taken things a little bit further. After this targeting, they issued some four statements saying that they launched several operations during the day. So after some de-escalation, now we see that the resistance in Lebanon has gone back to the same routine of continuous heavy firing against Israeli targets, whether in the Golan Heights or in occupied Palestinian territory, in occupied Lebanese territory. We have two operations in the Kfar Shuba Hills, the Lebanese occupied Kfar Shuba Hills in Al Samaka.
An explosive device has ripped through a car in the Syrian capital Damascus, but reportedly caused no casualties. According to Syrian media, blasts occurred in an upscale neighborhood where several foreign diplomatic missions are located. Details are still sketchy at this point, and there's been no claim of responsibility yet. It's still not immediately clear who was targeted in the explosion either. Now, security incidents, including blasts targeting military or civilian vehicles, happen intermittently in Damascus. People in Jordan have taken to the streets yet again in solidarity with Palestinians as anger mounts over U.S.-Israeli onslaught on Gaza. Protesters in the capital Amman waved Palestinian and Jordanian flags and condemned Israel's actions in Gaza. They also called for an immediate ceasefire in the war-ravaged Palestinian territory. People in Bahrain also took to the streets to voice support for Palestinians and resistance groups. Protesters denounced normalization of ties between the ruling Al-Khalifa regime in Manama and Tel Aviv. A pro-Palestine conference has been canceled by police in Germany's capital as the European country continues its crackdown on pro-Palestinian gatherings. Speakers from Palestine and around the world were supposed to address this conference. Our correspondent reports from Berlin.
German police have stormed the pro-Palestine conference in the capital Berlin and arrested a number of participants. The Palestine Congress was an important event for the Palestinian Solidarity Movement in Europe. It was set to be held in the German capital from April 12 to 14. The participants aimed to denounce Israeli apartheid and genocide and Germans' complicity in the genocide of the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip.
We are the Palestine Congress. We accuse the Israeli state of carrying out genocide. And we accuse the German government of supporting, of abetting, of making possible this genocide.
On Friday afternoon, several hundred activists assembled in South Berlin to attend the conference. Soon after the conference started, it was interrupted by the city's police, which had dispatched more than 900 police officers to the area. Outside the conference venue, police officers arrested a man for hoisting a Palestinian flag on a building. The participants inside the conference venue also faced repression. Even the registered journalists were refused entry by the police officers who had been deployed inside the conference hall.
I was in the list, and as the moment as I came, they told me I'm not allowed to enter because there were too many people already inside.
The first part of the conference focused on the history of Palestine.
May marks 76 years since the Palestinian Nakba. 76 years of colonization, of forced exile. However, next month also marks 76 years of resilience, 76 years of a struggle for liberation.
The German police stormed the event during a speech by the Palestinian researcher Salman Abu Sitta, who addressed the conference via video link because he had been not allowed to enter Germany. Police said he was subject to a ban on political activity in the country.
The Palestine Congress was happening. We were watching a video. The police came and shut down the electricity. They didn't give a justification about it. They didn't tell us why. Nevertheless, the police came here, shut it down, set it in the loudspeaker. People are supposed to leave the building right now. You see, they're already taking people.
Chaotic scenes followed. At least two people were arrested inside the hall and several others were interrogated. German Interior Minister Nancy Faeser hailed the police, saying it was good how the police had reacted.
An hour after the start of the conference, German police stormed the conference hall because of a speech on the history of Palestine. In an act of extreme repression, they broke up the conference, declaring it an illegal assembly. However, the Palestine Solidarity Movement vows to continue the conference tomorrow. Dieter Reinisch from Berlin.
Several people have been killed and a number of others seriously injured following a stabbing attack at a popular shopping mall in Sydney, Australia.
I'm advised that there are five victims who are now deceased as a result of the actions of this offender. There are more than several other people who have been conveyed to hospital. A number of those are in serious and or critical conditions at this stage.
The Assistant Police Commissioner of New South Wales confirmed a knife-wielding man was shot dead after he randomly stabbed shoppers. He didn't reveal the identity of the assailant, though. Several injured people were taken to area hospitals. Police say an investigation is underway to determine the reason behind this attack. Authorities have already evacuated the mall and asked people to avoid the area. Several posts on social media show crowds fleeing the mall and police cars and emergency services rushing to the spot. Witnesses said they heard shots and saw people lying on the ground and others taking shelter. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. When Israeli occupation forces invaded the Gaza Strip, the territory was divided into two halves, north and south, and Palestinians were separated as well. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Palestine Chronicle wrote, 6 months of relentless bombardment on the Gaza Strip have martyred and wounded over 110,000 people, displaced nearly 2 million out of the 2.3 million inhabitants of the Gaza Strip, and destroyed most of Gaza's residential buildings and infrastructure. But there is one dire consequence of Israel's genocidal war on Gaza that is rarely discussed. Many Palestinian families were divided and cannot be reunited under these horrific circumstances. The Palestine Chronicle spoke with three people who were separated from the rest of their families throughout 184 days of war. Their only hope is to be reunited with their beloved ones soon. Loy Haji told the Palestine Chronicle, "I used to live with my family in the village of Al-Maghra, in central Gaza, on the northern border of Wadi Gaza. At the beginning of the war, my wife and children went to her family's house in Gaza City out of fear of Israeli bombardment." Haji continued, "When Israeli occupation forces invaded the Gaza Strip, the territory was divided into two halves, north and south, and we were separated." He said, "Currently, I am displaced in a tent in Deir al-Balah, while my wife and children are still in Gaza City. I have no information about them as communications are almost cut off in Gaza City." Haji said in tears, "I miss my three children and my wife. I cannot wait to be together under one roof. It's been 5 months since I last saw them, 5 months without hearing my children's voice. I can't sleep thinking about them. I don't even know if they were targeted by an Israeli bombardment." Haji told the Palestine Chronicle that he constantly follows the news to get some information. He said, with a voice that grew more desperate as he spoke, "All I know is that they evacuated to my wife's family home on Sahaba Street in central Gaza City. From the news, I learned that the area was subjected to heavy shelling as Israeli airstrikes hit all areas in the Gaza Strip. I hope to reunite with my family and see them soon." Umm Qasim al-Daya used to live in the Nusayrat camp in central Gaza since he got married, while her family lived on Al-Thalathini Street in Gaza City. After the war, she evacuated with her husband's family to Deir al-Balah, then returned to al-Nusayrat camp about a month ago. Since the end of the temporary ceasefire on December 1st, she had no news about her family. Adaya said in tears, "My husband tries to calm me down, telling me that my family is fine, but I know he's lying to me because he doesn't know anything about them." She continued, "I try to call them repeatedly, but there is no network in Gaza City, and I was not able to reach them." Yusuf Kowaik stayed in Gaza City as long as he could. He refused to leave the city where he was born and raised. However, when the Israeli regime bombing intensified, Kowaik's wife decided to send their three daughters and their only son to her family house in Nusayrat in central Gaza. When the situation in Nusayrat worsened, they all evacuated to tents in Rafah City. Hubeik told the Palestine Chronicle. I occasionally check on them, but it is not easy to communicate. He continued, the phone network is unavailable in Gaza City, while the internet is only available in limited areas. In any case, it is extremely weak. Kuwait knows that in the overpopulated city of Rafah, there are no services, no food, and no medicine. He continued, I fear for my children from these difficult living conditions. The occupation threatens to invade Rafah every day, and I'm worried about these threats. I don't know where my wife will take my children if the occupation forces enter. Kuwait said in tears, I hope the war ends soon and I can reunite with my family. I miss hugging my children. Kuwait, however, wanted to let the Palestine Chronicle know that he did not lose hope. He concluded, this is the hardest war we've been through, but with our resilience, we will prevail and we will overcome all these hardships.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. The U.S.-Israeli genocide in Gaza has transformed the Palestinian coastal sliver into a living hell on earth. Add to that a deafening Western silence regarding the Israeli genocide of Gazans and active U.S. arms deals that contribute to the murder of more civilians, like the sons of Hamas political bureau chief Ismail Haniyeh. In this edition of the Spotlight, we'll look into the role that the United States is playing and the losses of the Israeli occupation forces and how Israel continues to dodge a ceasefire deal with various excuses with the intent to prolong the aggression. Well, joining us on this edition of the Spotlight, we have activist and political analyst Batu Sobeti joining us from London. And International Action Center Sarah Flounders joining us from New York.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to the program, to the both of you. Let's start off with Ms. Sobeti in London. Just about every crime imaginable has been committed against the people in Gaza for over 6 months now, from forced displacement to attacking schools and hospitals to famine and the crime of all crimes, of course, genocide. Give us your perspective on why the Israeli regime is acting in this savage manner against the entire civilian population.
Well, Israel's strategy is very clear. You know, create the most unbearable conditions and kill all life in Gaza. They have no idea what to do the day after the ceasefire. They ultimately have no strategy in place. Israeli security officials and politicians of the entity have discussed fully reoccupying Gaza and establishing complete security control, but they cannot do that because they've been unable to weaken the Gazan resistance. They can't accept the one-state solution because that would be a demographic nightmare for Israel. It relishes on the majority Jewish state. And if the Israeli occupation had any power, it would refuse every other solution that's being put by America. You know, currently that is the two-state solution and the Palestinian Authority consolidating its presence in Gaza. Israel sees that as a recipe for another war. The Gazan resistance is stronger and will win the next phase. So Israel is willing to sacrifice soldiers and even forego hostages because it considers this a war of survival and their last chance, ultimately, in which coexistence with the Gazan resistance is impossible. So given the fact that none of these solutions are working, it has no choice but to essentially forego all of Gaza. So its solution, so to speak, is to place the Gazawi under the most unbearable conditions and to make life so unhabitable that the only solution is to displace the people of Gaza, to get the international community, so to speak, to absorb them as refugees in the same way that it's been systemically doing since 1948. But what I would say is, given the population density of Gaza, the impracticability of displacing them, the international outrage at the occupation entity, the fortitude of the Gazans, most importantly, and that of the resistance, all of these solutions that Israel has in mind is ultimately built on illusions.
Right. Sarah Flounders, 189 days of relentless death and destruction. It's clear now that the Israeli war is not just on the resistance, but it's on all of the people of Gaza, isn't it?
Yes, and I couldn't agree more with the previous speaker, but this is total war against the whole population, particularly targeting the civilian population, because they are unable to reach, they're unable to defeat the resistance forces. So it's an effort to make the war on the civilians, particularly on the children, so horrendous that it demoralizes the Palestinian resistance. That hasn't happened. So really what's happening is Israel is facing a defeat and is thrashing about like a dying animal, without any regard for world opinion, without any regard even for its own future. It's staring complete defeat in the face because they've been unable to defeat the resistance. And they claimed going in that they would wipe out the resistance. They would never allow Hamas to govern again. This was the elected government in Gaza. They are in every way attempting to widen the war as another sort of failed effort to make the cost so horrendous. And yet, step by step, it moves forward. So whether it's in Yemen or whether it is in Lebanon or in Syria, Iraq, all the surrounding countries, it's clear that there is total support for the struggle in Gaza, and they can't reach the Gaza resistance, nor can they stop that fight. So no matter how many terrible weapons and crimes they commit, and it seems like there's a new crime each day that is so impossible even to picture that they would do this. They would plow whole bodies with earth movers in front of cameras, that they would kill all the patients and doctors and medical staff of hospitals. You just can't, that they would bomb a consulate. You know, you can't imagine any of these crimes taking place except that it shows a complete enraged frustration. Their whole plan was to totally disregard, bypass the Palestinians, and here they're being defeated every day and the whole world is watching it.
Ms. Obeidi, lack of food and essential nutrients in the Gaza Strip is causing death among children and newborns. Even the International Court of Justice has said famine has now turned from a risk into a chronic crisis for the civilian population in Gaza. How is fighting Hamas in any way tied to inducing famine and hunger on Palestinian children in Gaza?
Well, Right. It's precisely because they cannot weaken the Gazan resistance, ultimately, that they resort to these activities. You know, suppose Israel did manage to weaken the Gazan resistance. You know, ultimately, the equation that governs the unity of the fronts within the resistance axis will not allow the resistance in Gaza to fall. And ultimately, that's when you would see that full-fledged intervention from Lebanon and other countries like Yemen, Iraq, and Syria. Right now, the resistance axis is supporting Gaza, but that full-fledged intervention will come about if the Gazan resistance is weakened. But the reality is, it's not been weakened, and it's still standing strong. The occupation entity is unable to achieve a single strategic military objective on the ground. They're unable to locate the hostages. Even if they did, they're unable to take them out. You know, they're unable to locate or reach the location of the Gazan resistance to assassinate its leaders within Gaza. It's only managed to assassinate leaders like Aruri outside of Gaza. So they get brave with the family of Ismail Haniyeh, you know, his children. And that ultimately has no crucial effect or bearing on the situation on the ground. The infrastructure of the resistance is still very much intact. As we mentioned previously, the occupation entity is unable to reoccupy Gaza. All of its ground invasions have failed, and most recently it's been forced to withdraw from Khan Yunis after sustaining immense losses. So the occupation entity as a whole is lost. You know, internally it's fractured. You know, the Haredi Jews that don't want to be conscripted, that's going on. You know, you have the entity that is complaining about not having enough soldiers that want to fight. Their morale is very low. You know, even pre-October the 7th, you had 300,000 reserve force fighters who were actually, you know, striking, you know, in protest over the occupation entity's governmental laws. You know, the people on the streets ultimately want to see an end to this war because they deem it as a failure. They want to see the release of the hostages. So Israel's only plan right now really is to make life unlivable in Gaza, hoping that they can get the people of Gaza into despair to the extent where they can deport them and finish Gaza off altogether. It wants to finish from the headache of Gaza. You know, that was where the plan to displace them to the Naqab or the Sinai, that's as a result of that. Or, you know, the plan to build that humanitarian port that Israel quickly, the humanitarian port, right, that Israel quickly signaled the positive go-ahead light, ultimately, because that sees it as a route to get the displaced people of Gaza out. But what are the people of Gaza saying? Even if you pay us money to fly on planes and to leave Rafah, we will not do that. Because this is our land, and this is our right, and this is our dignity. We sacrificed so much to get to this point. We will not give up.
Sarah Flounder's outrage grows day by day over Israel's deadly attacks on Gaza aid convoys and aid workers. A UNICEF car came under fire in northern Gaza earlier this week on its way to deliver aid to malnourished children. Also, the United Nations says that it's gravely concerned over the Israeli airstrike that killed seven members of the U.S.-based charity the World Central Kitchen. Why isn't the international community doing more for the aid workers putting their lives on the line? And do you think that it's basically the U.S.'s support that has emboldened the Israelis to get to this point?
Well, to answer the last point first, it's absolutely U.S. support now and decades, 75 years of U.S. support, U.S. open funding, billions and billions of dollars, U.S. weapons investment, money, everything has given a green light to the entire Zionist society to feel they would always have a blank check, that no matter what they did, they would have U.S. support. And Biden reinforced that from the very first day of the war, that regardless of what it took, the U.S. would stand with this creation. If this is a U.S. creation for endless war in the entire region, and they will back up Israel to the limit. So while the UN can make some statements, they're not doing much at all, and they could do much more and have to do much more. And it's really the world movement that has to demand accountability of these international organizations. And I want to say from here in the U.S., we have to do much more, even though every single day there are just in the tens and tens of thousands of people in the streets, especially young people. But the support for Israel has collapsed And that is something that Israel will never recover from. And every member of the U.S. Congress is now even feeling the pressure. And U.S. corporations and banks that have invested so much money in Israel are feeling the pressure of a mass movement making demands, holding sit-ins and port shutdowns and school closings, one action after the other, extremely creative. But we have to continue that, and we have to actually increase those actions, not just in the staged demonstrations, but in all manner of confrontations that have been going on. I think they're very important, because every one of those actions is a way of saying, we refuse to go along with this. Polls now in the U.S., and this is staggering, show that the population, overwhelmingly, the majority of the population is with Palestine. That's amazing when you consider the criminal role that the U.S. corporate media has played every single day in backing up Israel's crimes and in hiding their crimes. And yet, nevertheless, it is seeping through into the population as a whole. So, yes, the U.S. is emboldening Israel, and the mask is off. I think around the world, and even right here in the U.S., and this is also true in Britain and in the EU, there is a recognition of the crimes of their own countries and a demand for accountability. And we have to, as I say, we have to step that up. The idea that aid workers can be attacked with complete impunity again right. And again and again. These really are unfathomable crimes, and they need to be confronted legally, but also in the streets and in the resistance right here.
Ms. Sobeiti, have all the years of impunity in U.S. cover for Israel made this child-killing regime believe that it is above the law and is safe from accountability? Close to 200 aid workers have been killed in the Israeli onslaught on Gaza. That's the highest number of aid worker deaths ever recorded in any conflict, and that is no accident.
Right. Ultimately, the core last week between Biden and Netanyahu, I believe, was quite significant, because it reiterated how America is actually leading the battle for Israel and will decide on the appropriate action when U.S. strategy is not followed through and actually when U.S. interests become harmed. Israel is a proven failure. Ultimately, from America's perspective, it needs to be put on the side, and political action needs to take its course. That is beginning with a ceasefire, hostage exchange, in addition to letting aid into Gaza. But ultimately, I do believe right now Israel is no longer safe from a lack of accountability. It's only gotten away with the lack of accountability for all these years because the world had ultimately turned a blind eye. So the West allowed Israel to continually transgress beyond and beyond. But today what we're seeing is there's a real swing in public mood against the occupation entity. It is spanning the whole world. You know, the billion-dollar Israeli lobby is unable to reverse this. And that is unprecedented. And that is ultimately because the events on the ground are to a magnitude that is so large that it overcomes all of the Zionist lobbying efforts. The occupation entity today is in danger of becoming a pariah within global politics. You know, the West has reached a point where it just cannot cover up for Israel's crimes. You know, Israel has been exposed as a rogue entity. And this war ultimately has exposed the masks, you know, and those false values that are advocated by the West. You have world thinkers today that are starting to discuss the inevitability of Israel's demise and its lack of ability to survive in light of its failures. And ultimately, this has everything to do with the pressure that the people, especially in the West, are applying onto their governments to distance them from the occupation entity. Today, we're seeing Europe's lack of enthusiasm to support Israel. We're seeing bold changes in the official positions of countries like Southern America, you know, Brazil, Colombia, the unprecedented criminalization of Israel through international bodies. So I do firmly believe that the tides are shifting, and especially post-war, we will increasingly see Israel being held to real account. Right now, America's walking with Israel because it's like its injured child, so to speak, and they're waiting for this ceasefire to be invoked so that they can really and truly hold Israel to account for its huge failures.
Sure. Sarah Flounders, the Iranian president, Ebrahim Raisi, he's recently said that freedom-seeking and independent countries need to make a concerted effort to put pressure on Tel Aviv to stop its atrocities. Why aren't regional blocs, and most notably Arab governments, stepping up and taking matters into their own hands? As we know, many officials have called on Muslim and Arab countries to openly express their opposition to Israel and to sever ties with the Israeli regime. Why is that not happening? And how much of the situation today is a result of the complacency of some Arab governments, especially the U.S. allies in the region?
Well, the complacency and really compliance of these governments is based on a completely corrupt agreement made for decades with U.S. power and U.S. money in the region, and U.S. buying off of officials, royal families that are appointed. It really is the whole, that is what is being shaken far beyond Gaza today, that the popular movements, the mass movements are demanding of their government action and accountability. And these governments are willing to make some paper shows, some photo ops. They're going to send in a few supplies, but of course they're not in any way doing what they could be doing. And this is true for the government of, particularly of Egypt and Jordan, where so much more could be done and is not being done because they've profited. Small groups of people have profited over these criminal arrangements made with the U.S., and they fear losing U.S. support, U.S. money. They have militaries that have been trained by right here at bases in the United States. So they have a whole thread of relations that enchains them, the officials and the military regimes of these countries and several other countries too. So I do think the people of the region are demanding accountability and stepping up their efforts. That will create a change. And that's coming through. And it's what there is such fear on the part of U.S. officials that this could all break apart. They have spent so much over many decades creating this web to keep the whole region down and compliant and colonialized, or there's neo-colonialism, as we would say, Israel making a direct colony in Palestine, and yet these relations that disrupt life internally continue. But they're breaking apart, and they're breaking apart because the population as a whole is united in supporting Gaza, overwhelmingly feeling that recognition. I think the U.S. position globally is shaken as it's never been before. It's amazing. But what is happening on a global basis with many countries around the world, not just in the region, seeing the duplicity, the crimes, and what the U.S. will do to back up its proxy states, seeing how far they would go, is creating a horror. And that's really leading to the undermining of the U.S. position, not only of Israel, but also of U.S. imperialism on a global basis. It's really happening and unthreading.
Ms. Sabaiti, Iran says Israel's recent attack on its embassy in Damascus, which violated the immunity of diplomatic venues, necessitates legitimate defense with the objective of punishing the aggressor. So Iran's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdullahi, and he says that punishment here is necessary as Israel has shown total disregard for international law and the Vienna conventions. Do you agree with the Iranian foreign minister's comments? And why would Israel carry out such an attack, which would risk a serious escalation in the region?
Right. The Israeli attack on the Iranian consulate put them in a very bad place. Between direct retaliation and ultimately granting Iran a big opportunity, you know, to be an important party to any solution in favor of the Gazan resistance, there is no doubt that the Iranian response is coming. No matter how big or small it is, depends on the negotiations. And on that basis, I don't think we'll be seeing the response quite soon. Ultimately, though, Iran has the strongest cards. To use this, though, it needs to threaten with the maximum retaliation in a way in which their enemy will calculate and explore all of the potential responses. So here, Iran is giving them an alternative. You know, that is, if you do not wish for maximum penalty, then you have to agree to a ceasefire and compromises that are on the terms of the resistance. So ultimately, this strong Iranian card of retaliation is actually now in the hands of the negotiators of the Hassan resistance. And that's a very strong card. You know, and if this card is walking and the occupation entity withdraws from Gaza completely. You know, recently we saw the withdrawal from Khan Yunis that took place. So if moving forward, you know, they agree on the return of Palestinians to the north, a kind of ceasefire deal is reached, in that case, the direct Iranian response would be limited to smaller targets. It wouldn't be of a threat nature. But I certainly believe that if Iran reaches a deal that establishes a ceasefire, then Iran would have ultimately secured the greater victory. And that is the total defeat of the occupation entity, because the war would have ended with the Hassan resistance still standing. Now, in terms of the trajectory of the war, it is not escalatory, because the resistance is very calculated. They don't get dragged to any square. They account for the higher interest. You know, their goal is for the aggression of Gaza to end, and in the process to establish new deterrence equations. You know, through October the 7th, the Axis managed to secure many points of victory. Perhaps Netanyahu at this current moment doesn't want to avoid the Iranian hit. Perhaps he wants to implicate America along with it. But Netanyahu's stupidity lies where? It's in thinking that he can drag America to something that they don't want. He thinks he can drag America to expanding the war. They think America will get involved if Iran attacks the occupation entity hard enough. But the worst thing for America's position right now in the region is expansion of the war. With every confrontation with the resistance axis, America's standing in the region is weakening. If America was thinking about expanding the war, it would have launched much larger forces into the region. And even if the US were to reallocate its forces regionally in a war with Iran, that would take months of preparation and assembling. So the mobilization of resources for war is politically and militarily unsustainable for the US. The US has no capability nor desire to engage in a wider regional war. To deploy its troops, it would need access to ports, to airfields where military infrastructure and soldiers can land in. Iran has the ability to attack these and render them unusable. So America's not stupid enough to expand the war and fight on Israel's behalf. It's what Israel's yearning for. It's not going to give it to them, because America will not step on its interests for Israel that it created to protect Western interests.
Okay, that's all the time we have for tonight's show. Allow me to thank my guests, activist and political analyst Batul Sobeti, joining us from the British capital, London, and from the International Action Center, Ms. Sarah Flounders, speaking to us from New York. Also, thanks for staying with us on tonight's Spotlight. It's good night for now.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day, from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day, from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. Now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
لا إله إلا الله لا إله إلا الله.
Answering the doubts and questions and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah هو ذا الرحمن.
Allah
هو ذا المنان.
لا إله إلا.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. We welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I am Atta, the host of this program. Sheikh Rouhani is the guest speaker for today's discussion. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh. Welcome to the show.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Questions and Answers on Islamic Beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
Inshallah, 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 you'll find your way.
Alright, Sheikh, for today's episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs, we want to ask, is really committing sins the root of all the problems and the afflictions that we have in this world? And is it alright that, for example, a person's child got sick because of the sinning of his parents or her parents? First, let's talk about the first part of the question. Is sinning the main root and the source of most of the problems today's people have?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Yes, generally, it is true to say that our sins will have its negative impact on our lives. And not only our own lives, also if the sin has a social kind of aspect, it will have, of course, its social impact, negative impact on the other people as well. Generally, we could say that sometimes the hardships, the difficulties, the problems, diseases, challenges, hardships that we face in our life, it is due to the sins that we commit. Generally, yes. It is true.
Okay.
Because sometimes, for example, Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wants to test us, wants to examine us. He, for example, provided us with some opportunities, chances, but if we misuse or, let's say, abuse, we can say, those opportunities, for example, to do wrong things, to perform wrong things, wrong deeds, and that kind of making use of those opportunities, of course, it will deprive us from the rahmah of Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. It will deprive us from the mercy of Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. It is quite clear that, yes, it has its own impact on us. That's why we should always be mindful and careful about our sins, because it does not have only its impact on ourselves, rather on others as well.
That's all right. Okay. For sure, we can say that's right. Committing a sin has effects on spirituality too, Shaykh. I mean, as most of the Islamic teachings and Islamic teachers have said, it is like making darker spots on your white soul. And the sinnings and the effects of the sinning are not going to be evaporated or cleaned easily. Even when you die, they remain on your soul. So is it true that the committing of the sin of a person might have effects on the lives of other people, especially the close ones, like children, or not?
You know, in this world, in this universe, what we can say is this, that in the creation, we have some kind of rules which goes to the nature of this world. It means that this universe has some natural kind of rules or principles that will be, let's say, fulfilled naturally in this world. For example, in Farsi it is said, "Gandum az gandum beruyat jawz jaw."
As mukafat amal ghafil mashou. Yes.
Yeah, it means that you should be always mindful about what seed you plant, for example, in the ground, in the land.
Mm-hmm.
Then whatever you plant it, you will grow. It will grow the same thing, you know?
Yes.
So that's why this is the nature. It means that if you do something,